This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. As many as 60 people were reported wounded, and at least one person, a 13-year-old girl, was killed over this past weekend in a clash between protesters and Chinese police in Guangdong Province in southern China, not far from Hong Kong. Protesters by villagers over government land seizures exploded when thousands of police officers tried to suppress demonstrators with automatic weapons and electric stun batons. A month earlier, Chinese officials opened fire into another crowd of villagers in Guangdong Province, reportedly killing 20. Over the years since the massacre of protesters in Tiananmen Square, Western countries, including the United States, have expanded trade and investment in China in part because they believe the rapid economic growth will inevitably lead to political reform. The Communist Party remains firmly in control in China. No political opposition is tolerated, but there do appear to be some cracks in the authoritarian facade. Demonstrations like those in Guangdong Province are growing as villagers object to the seizure of homes and farms to build new factories and highways. There's also a dramatic gap between urban and rural development, between rich and poor in China. People are speaking out. The government appears to be cracking down. Merle Goldman writes about all this in a new book called From Comrade to Citizen, The Struggle for Political Rights in China. She is Professor Emerita of Chinese History at Boston University and our guest on the latest installment in our series on China and the 21st century. Later in the program, we'll talk with a professor of military strategy, Elliot Cohen. His book about leadership in wartime became a must-read for Bush administration officials in the period running up to the beginning of the war in Iraq. Now he's offering his thoughts on what might have gone wrong there. But first, political change in China. If you've been to China lately, call and tell us about the political atmosphere there. How much freedom is there to speak out or to organize? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is talk@npr.org. That's a new email address, talk@npr.org. Merle Goldman joins us now from the studios at Harvard University's press office in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and it's nice to have you on Talk of the Nation.
Thank you.
Your book is called From Comrade to Citizen. Obviously, last weekend's events and last month's are too recent to be in your book, but how much do these protests indicate change or resistance in any case?
Well, it indicates both, actually. It's very clear that people are expressing their dissatisfaction. And one way in which they do it is through protest, because they can't do it through any other way. There are no institutionalized channels for expressing discontent. There's no free press. There certainly is no a Congress or Parliament where these views can be expressed. So the only way they really have to express themselves are through protest. And the party itself, the Chinese Communist Party itself, said that in the year 2004, there were 74,000 protests. So that indicates that something's going on, or some changes are going on in China.
I have to remember, China's a very big country, so that's not exactly a wave of unrest, but it's significant.
It is.
Now, the Communist Party is also not the same as it was under Chairman Mao. This is no longer a place where people are told where to live and who you're going to work for.
Right. Actually, beginning with the reforms in the late 1970s, and China opened up to the rest of the world and moved to a market economy, there was a loosening up over most areas of Chinese life. People could talk freely among themselves. That they couldn't do under Mao because they feared being reported. But certainly in the post-Mao era, there's much more freedom of expression. What there isn't is freedom of association. That if any group tries to get together to bring about some kind of political change, then there will be a crackdown. At the same time, there is the emergence in China of a civil society. But it's a civil society that has to be registered with the government. And it's only on particular issues, non-political issues, such as women's issues, education, and environmental issues. But all of these, of course, have political implications.
Give us a couple of for instances. For example, there was an organization called the China Democracy Party back in the 1990s.
Right. I describe that in my book. In 1998, a group of the veterans, and this is a very interesting phenomenon, veterans from the Cultural Revolution and from the 1989 demonstrations in Tiananmen Square joined together to try to organize a opposition party. And it's very interesting. These two generations seem to be the most politically active. And the question is, why the Cultural Revolution generation? And in many ways, Mao himself set this up because he told the young people to rebel against authority. And then when they rebelled against authority and caused chaos, he then sent them out to the countryside. Well, in the countryside, they became aware that the revolution wasn't really bringing about this great new world that he told them was going on, that the peasants were living in very bitter circumstances. And they began to question the whole system. So that after Mao died and they came back to their homes in the cities, they started a demonstration. It was called the Democracy Wall Movement. Mm-hmm. And they called for political reform. This was in 1979. And Deng Xiaoping cracked down on that. And then in the late 1980s, as many people know, there were demonstrations all over China, all over in China's major cities, demanding political reform. And then again, Deng Xiaoping sent in the soldiers against the demonstrators on June 4th, 1989, and that ended those demonstrations. Nonetheless, the veterans of these two movements have continued to try to build up some kind or bring about some kind of political change. And so in 1998, they started to organize a political opposition. It started in the city of Wuhan. It spread to the coastal areas. It spread inland. And they were able to get the movement off the ground for about almost a year. And then, of course, the party cracked down very severely. But the very fact that you could even get a movement like this going in this authoritarian regime, that was significant.
And you use the word authoritarian as opposed to totalitarian, the distinction right. being the amount of control the government has over your life, I guess.
That's true. In other words, under Mao, it was literally total control over one's life. People were told what to wear, where to live, what to think, what to say. They had to criticize their colleagues if they didn't toe the line. They had to write or make public confessions if they didn't toe the line. That kind of severe control, that has been lifted. And since the late 1970s, as China moved to a market economy, and now people have their own some of them have their own independent income. They have a greater degree, certainly, of economic freedom. Yet this is still an authoritarian government.
If you'd like to join our conversation with Merle Goldman, a professor emerita of Chinese history at Boston University and author of From Comrade to Citizen, The Struggle for Political Rights in China, our number is 800-989-8255. You can also send us email. talk@npr.org is the address. And let's take a call from Sigmund. Sigmund is calling us from New York City.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm having a little trouble hearing you. Can you hear me?
Yes, we're hearing you fine, Sigmund. Go ahead, please.
Okay, fine. Yeah, I've been to China three times in the last 5 years. And, of course, most of the time I was dealing with people who spoke English because I only know a few phrases in Mandarin. And but I did go around the lot and ask people about their feelings vis-a-vis their political freedom, their economic freedom, what they could do, what they couldn't do. And the people I was speaking with, drivers, translators, even people in hotels, and once in a while someone who would just walk up to me on the street, all seemed, one, fairly happy. They were happy to see Americans. And two, they told me, especially in Shanghai, for instance, they said as long as they didn't get involved in politics, they could do just about anything they wanted to do. People were carrying PDAs. People were walking around with laptops. People were driving nice new shiny cars and wearing Western-style clothes. And people were talking about making money in stock markets and all the kinds of things you hear in the West. I was quite surprised, especially in Shanghai.
And I guess the operative phrase there, Merle Goldman, is as long as they didn't get involved in politics.
That's right, as long as they didn't get involved in politics. And you must remember that the Internet itself is censored. The government filters out certain kinds of words, such as democracy, human rights, Tibet, for example. The sensitive words are filtered out, and people have been put in prison for some of the messages they have sent over the Internet. So, yes, it is. People look happy. But actually, I was in China in 1974, which was toward the end of the Cultural Revolution, and people looked happy then, too. I don't think that is a good way to judge it, but I certainly would agree with the caller that on a personal level, people can say almost anything they want. It's when they try to, in any way, organize for some kind of political action, that's when they really run into trouble.
Sigmund, thanks for the call.
Thank you.
And I wonder, though, about this growing tension, and that seems inevitable as well in China, between the haves that Sigmund was describing with their PDAs and their laptops, and the many more Chinese still in the countryside, still desperately poor.
That is true. And with the move to the market, almost everybody benefited, including the peasants in the countryside. Mm-hmm. The problem is that over time, there have been increasing inequalities. The urban areas have jumped ahead economically. The rural areas have not. They have not done as well. And so that is one problem. Another major problem is that they've lost what we call their social security system. The health care, which earlier under Mao was supplied by the barefoot doctors who would come into a village, clean up the water, give injections, that was sufficient to give China a life expectancy of a developed country. There are no more barefoot doctors, or the barefoot doctors are now charging for their services. So that health care for the majority of the population has been lost, and that's a real problem. One of the reasons for these protests that we see going on in the countryside today is that the local government, along with developers, are literally taking over land and not paying enough compensation to the peasants on that land,
We hear complaints about eminent domain seizures in this country, nothing like what goes on in China.
That's right. And they talk, the leaders talk about the rule of law, but there is no way that they can really deal with this problem, because you do not have an independent judiciary. So that is unlikely, if they took this question to the courts, that they would get any kind of satisfaction. So there's this great unhappiness welling up in the countryside because of the takeover of land with very little compensation, the loss of health care. And in the cities, the unhappiness is due in part to the fact that state industries are being privatized. And when they're privatized, workers lose their jobs. And it is a very dynamic economy. And some workers are obviously able to get jobs, but some other workers are not. So that is the problem in the urban areas.
We're talking about political change in China. Our guest is Merle Goldman. More of your calls after a short break. 800-989-8255 or email us talk@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. Back after the break, it's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're discussing political change in China, though that country is experiencing very rapid economic growth. Political change is much slower. While the Communist Party is still in control, there are signs of political awakening as more Chinese protest against government actions like land seizures. Our guest is Merle Goldman, professor of Chinese history emerita at Boston University. Of course, you're invited to join us. If you've been to China lately, what did you observe about the political atmosphere there? 800-989-8255. Email is talk@npr.org. And let's get another caller on the line. This is Derek. Derek's calling us from Round Lake in Illinois.
Yes, thank you very much for having me on the air.
Sure.
As a consultant, also as a student, I lived in China, and I occasionally travel there. One thing I'd like to also criticize is the role of the American Western companies into the so-called modernization of Chinese economic and political scene. I think American companies and government tend to look at a situation in China from more from a pro-Soviet type of environment, where liberalization would automatically bring, you know, bigger amounts of freedom and bigger way of Western Judeo-Christian way of thinking into the population. First of all, China is a mostly Confucian state, has a very old values, which go up to 5,000 years, and it's simply not going to develop into our ways of human values and human rights, what have you. And frankly, Western companies are very opportunistic into supporting the status quo, which takes place in China, by having very strong influence over its people, as long and giving them enough personal freedom as long as they don't get involved in the politics.
Mm-hmm.
And the biggest example of that is the Yahoo case, where they helped the portal case, which they helped to imprison the Chinese or at least imprison Chinese journalists. And the funny thing is, last week they appealed the case, which originally was designated in France for sale of the Nemazi memorabilia. They appealed it to the U.S. court.
Right.
So it's really, I think, shows a lot of hypocrisy, also on part of the Microsoft, a lot of corporations that do business in China. From my personal experience, I deal with a lot of Fortune 500 companies. They're pretty abashedly open about simply taking advantage of the cheap resources and human resources and also special deals with the government that allows them to take advantage of, to prolong this type of state of, malaise, social political malaise.
Well, let me ask Admiral Goldman about that. Are American companies interested in, one of the things they're interested in is stability, one would think.
They certainly are interested in the stability. They're at the same time, for example, the way in which the Chinese have been able to crack down on people on the internet is with the help of American companies. Yahoo helped them track down a young man who tried to send out some news about what was going on in China that China said were state secrets. But the market, it is so important to be in China at this point economically that American companies say that they have to go along with Chinese laws in order to really carry on their business. But I would like to just say one thing about Chinese culture and civilization. Chinese culture and civilization certainly is different from Western culture and civilization, but it certainly Confucianism talked about fair play, about treating the population fairly. And the other countries, what we call post-Confucian countries, Japan, Taiwan, and South Korea, all those countries now are democratic countries. So I believe that there's nothing in China's traditional culture that will prevent it from moving in a more democratic direction.
Well, it's interesting, Professor Goldman, you do write that in earlier eras, experiments with Western-sounding values during the Qing and Republican eras, people considered rights not as inherent natural rights but as given by the state. Now, that's very different from Western political tradition.
That certainly is different from Western culture. There's no question. But certainly the idea of human rights is not in itself foreign to them because they do believe in fair play. And the Chinese government itself has signed on to the two UN covenants on economic rights and the one on political rights, so that the population itself, those people who are interested in political reform, say, well, we have signed on to these covenants. Now we have to carry them out. So the government itself has said that these are the kinds of rights that they want to establish.
If I can add one more thing.
Go ahead, Derek. Yeah.
The issue is that China seems to be politically going reversing back to the period of imperial dynasty system where we have de facto now Red Dynasty, and some of the power which they are trying to modernize and the way of doing business is simply going to be stalled by local governments, which have a very quite a surprising amount of power because they're far from Beijing. Therefore, they will give a lip service as far as reform, as far as complying with the central government directives. But on a local level, they pretty much do whatever they want. And according to some of the reports from NPR, also from the foreign media, a lot of times, whatever the local party boss says is actually the law, regardless what the central government says. So I think there's a lot of a reference in the past where you had a situation where, you know, local warlords and rulers had to pay the homage to Beijing or Nanjing, whatever the capital was at the time, in order to preserve their own specific local power, regardless whatever the agenda of the central government was. And I'll just take it off the air. Thank you very much.
Thanks for the call, Derek.
Well, I do agree with the caller on that. With the move to the market, China became much more decentralized. And because of that, the central government has less control over the local areas. And they have a hard time really bringing the local areas in line with their policy so that local warlords, as they call it, or local officials can really do almost anything they want at this point. And that is certainly a major problem. And that's one of the reasons why various reformers in China say we have to have a move towards a more federal system or more democratic system, so that there's some way to incorporate or co-opt these local areas into a centralized system.
Let's get another caller on. This is Barbara. Barbara is with us from Kalamazoo in Michigan.
Thank you. Hello.
Hi.
I was in China, in Beijing and Shanghai and Xi'an in 2001 when the real millennium hit. And it was a really interesting experience. But I think one of the prime problems is that we don't understand their system of government. It is not a government of law. It is a government of men. And I was with a group of attorneys, and the whole purpose of the trip was to interface with lawyers from China and judges and to see their legal system. And at that time, the ABA had come on strong about personal rights, and so they kind of did not go through with what we were supposed to see. They were kind of angry at the Americans calling them names. But what they said was, if there was, for instance, a franchise and a contract and they breached it and we wanted recourse, well, if the man changed his mind, then the contract was not effective. You had no recourse. And that's one of the prime barriers to business. Another one is they don't recognize copyrights or trademarks or any of those kinds of things, patents. And so they have excellent means of copying anything we have, whether it's watches or jewelry or cars or manufactured goods, and they don't understand why we're angry. They're using entrepreneurial skills, and after all, flattery is the highest form of praise, and they truly...
Imitation is the highest form of flattery, but go ahead.
Yeah, so it's until we can have a meeting of the minds as far as business procedures, I don't see how we can have effective trade relationships.
That's an interesting point. And Merle Goldman, in answering it, I was wondering if you could tell us the story that you write about a lawyer by the name of Ma Wenlin.
Right. Well, it is true that the leaders talk about we need the rule of law. They're moving very slowly towards that. And the most part, there is no rule of law. But nonetheless, there are changes. You begin to see the emergence of defense lawyers for the very first time who will come in and defend people that are accused of various political crimes. That's something new. Chinese are coming abroad and studying in our universities, and they go back very much committed to trying to set up a system of the rule of law. It's slow. There's no question about that. And certainly on the local level, it's very, very, very difficult. But the fact that people that are accused of political crimes can find a lawyer to defend them today, that is certainly progress.
And that was what Ma Wenlin did.
Yes. Yeah, and there was another interesting thing. A lot of the law I do is family-based, and I represent abused and neglected children. And so when we were at one of the conferences with a group of lawyers, and by the way, they were all men, despite the fact that they say that women are most welcome at any level, there were none in the partnership, there were none at the table with us, and when we went to the law school at the University of Beijing, we were able to speak with the dean of the school. We were not permitted to interface with any of the students or the professors. So I asked, what happens in China if there's child abuse? Will the teacher get punished? I said, no, what if it's the parents? Oh, parents would never abuse the children. Well, there's still girl infanticide. So it's still, they've got a long way to go before we are able to understand and deal with them on a level footing.
Barbara, thanks very much for the call. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Let's talk now with Todd. Todd's calling from Norman, Oklahoma.
Hello.
Hi.
Yes, I have to go. I've got to teach a class. I'm a professor at the University of Oklahoma, and I've lived in Taiwan many years, and I just was recently in China to attend a conference in the city of Xiamen, where it was really interesting because Xiamen is so similar to Taiwan in many ways. And just like to make a brief comment about the differences between Taiwan and China. China is extremely impressive. The city of Xiamen in particular was beautiful. And it was so clean, and the government has done an outstanding job cleaning up the city for tourism. And it was very familiar to Taiwan. It was cleaner than many places in Taiwan. But when you start talking to people, there are pressures such as the one-child policy, such as the fact the government owns all the land and can take it away from you. There was a discontent, and there was one comment that an American who was teaching at Shanghai University, he's been there for 13 years, he said, I was talking about the healthcare system. Taiwan is more socialist than China. China is much more capitalist. I was shocked to learn that they did away with national healthcare in Taiwan. It's a wonderful, and it's much more middle class kind of system. But China is a place. My impression was, if you just work and you make money, everything is great, but there's an underlying discontent. I was talked to another man who had a factory, and he was saying the government wasn't supporting him at all, rather that they were, because he was too small, but and he was very upset. He kept talking and telling me how upset he was. So China really would like Taiwan under the fold, but Taiwan, I don't think people from Taiwan would ever want to live under the system as China has been experiencing.
Well, China, Taiwan is a subject for another whole show, but Merle Goldman, about Todd's points about Chinese discontent.
Yeah, let me just interject there. You have to remember, though, that when Chiang Kai-shek went to Taiwan, he put it under a very severe authoritarian government. But very gradually, you began to see changes, and it began with village elections. And then the village elections moved up to township elections. And then there was a loosening up of controls. So that when his son, Zhang Jinghua, came to power in 1987, he said, okay, he said, we've had these great changes. We have a democracy. And he says, we have democracy today. So it was a combination of movement from below and finally a leadership that wanted to bring about democracy. And the great hope is that China might move in that direction. It's much bigger. It's much more difficult. There's no question about that. But China also now has village elections. It hasn't moved up yet to the township elections, but certainly 90% of the villages in China, they now vote for their local leaders. That doesn't mean you have democracy. Certainly doesn't. But there is change going on.
Todd, thanks very much for the call.
Okay,
good luck with your class.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. We're talking with Merle Goldman about her book, From Comrade to Citizen, The Struggle for Political Rights in China. And if you'd like to listen to the previous story in our China series, you can go to our website at npr.org. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And you use the word citizen in the title of your book, Merle Goldman. Does China have much history with the idea of citizen?
Well, they have a term for it, gungren, and they got that term from the Japanese in the late 19th century. So they do talk about it. And the definition of citizen in the Chinese context is political rights. And certainly in those early decades of the 20th century, there were groups of intellectuals certainly who tried to bring about and establish political rights. So it is not really alien to China, certainly in the 20th century. So the concept of citizen is you could say, over 100 years old in China. It is not a foreign concept.
Let's see if we can get another caller on the line. This is Bill. Bill calling us from Chelsea in Michigan.
Hi.
Hi. Go ahead, Bill, please.
Yes. My question is about corruption in China. We have an authoritarian government, but how much control does the authoritarian government have with corruption? The other day you were talking about, I think, pollution in China, and how does the government enforce pollution controls whenever the local officials are so corrupt?
Yeah, checks and balances seem to be missing.
How much really control does that government have with in terms of corruption?
Very little control. And the leadership is very concerned about, the leadership in Beijing is very concerned about this. But this, of course, has to do also with this loosening up of power of the central leadership. And the local officials are essentially corrupt. In fact, one of the reasons for all those demonstrations, one very important reason for them is corruption. They are protesting against corrupt officials who are given money to pay off, for example, people who lose their jobs or people who lose their land. And the protests say the officials are taking their money for themselves. So there is no way at this point to really control corruption. In fact, the new leadership, this is called the fourth generation of leaders in China under Hu Jintao, have launched an ideological campaign very similar to that were launched in the Mao period to make people study ideology, and they hope this will stop the corruption, but it certainly isn't going to stop the corruption. It is really very widespread in China.
Bill, thanks for the call. Merle Goldman, we just have a couple of minutes with you before we have to end. Do you think, obviously, change is happening. Change is the one constant anywhere in the world. Is it going to be slow, gradual, incremental, progressive, or is it going to go by fits and starts and be unpredictable?
I think fits and starts is a good way of doing it. We in the West think that if you develop a middle class, it will be that middle class that will demand or political rights. But what we're finding in China is that the new entrepreneurial class is being co-opted into the Chinese Communist Party. They are the major social group now coming into the Chinese Communist Party. So that the kind of change that we saw in the West coming from this independent, what we call a bourgeoisie, doesn't seem to be happening here. It's really those people, the people who've lost their jobs, the people that are losing their lands, the intellectuals who've been persecuted, those are the people that are demanding some kind of political change. And the kind of change they want is one of a system that we can understand, a system of checks and balance, to check these officials, to check their corruption, to check the confiscation of their land. That's extremely important to them. So that I think it's going to be slow. I think it's going to come in fits and starts, as you would call it. But you have to remember, China today is close to 90% literate. They are open to the outside world. They have a market economy, which gives them a certain degree of freedom. They're beginning to think more on their own. And certainly, I think with time, you're going to build up pressure from below for some kind of political change.
Merle Goldman, thanks very much for being with us. We appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Merle Goldman, Professor Emerita of Chinese History at Boston University and Associate at the John K. Fairbanks Center for East Asian Research at Harvard University. Her book, Comrade, From Comrade to Citizen, The Struggle for Political Rights in China. When we come back from a short break, Elliot Cohen will join us to discuss military strategy in Iraq and other wars and mistakes that were made. I'm Neil Conan. We'll be back after the break. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.